I get for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Iram Guru Radha Mandalakam Niyata Yami. Okay. I brought, I could, this class could get away from me easily. so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it. But anyway, these are, remember I used the word sadhana? What does that mean, sadhana? Is that a fan? If you're warm enough to need a fan, maybe we can cut the air conditioning.
Right now, it's okay.
Okay. All right. Well, now you're making me hot. So. Anyway. Now, what was I talking about here?
Sadhana.
What's a sadhana? All the way in the back. Anybody get any clue? How about over here?
Take a guess. It's like a retreat, meditation.
Nope. These are sadhanas. Ta-da. They're books. They're books. They're guided meditations. We all, you know, like for example, each of the deities. I've got one here for Medicine Buddha over there, the blue one. Right? If you were going to do a retreat, if we wanted to do that practice, which we certainly could, the mantra is a little hard to memorize, so I'm not going to do it. But that's now Form Chenrezig is kind of nice. Let's see Form Chenrezig here. There's a thousand arm Chenrezig, another thousand arm Chenrezig, but I don't see Form Chenrezig. Anyway, there's White Tara Sadhana in the back over there. That's a long life particular manifestation of Tara. And there's Green Tara. Where is she? Anybody see her? Very good. You are very astute. Green Tara, the beautiful green lady. And they even have Shakyamuni Buddha meditation, and I was debating with myself whether or not to do this, because there's Does anybody remember reading in the texts about front generations and self generations and stuff like that? Anything come up about that? Anyway, in the Kriya Tantra, the lower levels of Tantra, you're still using your understanding of emptiness, but the deity is visualized in front of you, and usually. Sometimes it could be over the head, but you're not really permitted to, unless you've had a great initiation into the practice, you're not really permitted to see yourself as the deity. In other words, so there are a few practices where there is one practice, the Sakti Shakyamuni Buddha, and I thought that would be more interesting if we could do that, because that's the one, and it's not even a tantric practice. It's not considered I've never heard of anybody say the tantric practice of Shakyamuni Buddha, but there are. You know, it's laid out as a tantric sadhana. And we can imagine ourselves, I mean, the Zen practitioners do this all the time, don't they? They say, I'm Buddha now. That's a big part of Zen, is that you see yourself as a Buddha now. It sounds very tantric, doesn't it? But anyway, it's said that you can, arise as the deity in using Shakyamuni Buddha as the object. So that, I think, that would be more, that would be closer to what we're really trying to do in the other levels of Tantra and Highest Yoga Tantra. Usually when you're practicing Highest Yoga Tantra, like Kala Chakra, for example, or any of the Highest Yoga Tantra manifestations, always, you arise as the deity. And now, if there are a lot of, in the iconography and stuff, there's male and female in sexual union, right? You see that a lot in Highest Yoga Tantra. So if you're male, are you in the visualization, are you the male or are you the female? If you're the female, if you're female in the visualization, are you a female or a male? This is a quiz question. You get extra credit if you answer it right. Susie's got it right on the tip of her tongue.
I was thinking what I would do.
You're both. You're both. You're both. There's no distinction. I'm sorry?
I would roll the dice. Which one?
Well, you're both, actually. Because the point is not to be male or female, but the point is the union of method and wisdom, the union of bliss and emptiness. That's the point. The symbolic meaning of it. Of course, it's very graphic and stuff like that, but there's a lot of... Every implement, I mean, if you look at Kala Chakra, I mean, every one of those implements in his or her hand, because it's male and female there, they have symbolic meaning. I think there might be like 28 or 26, there's a lot. And each implement has profound symbolic meaning. And as a Highest Yoga Tantric practitioner, if you're visualizing yourself as the deity, what's the most important part of deity yoga? What's the most important part of deity yoga? Ta-da!
Seeing the teacher and the deity and yourself as one.
I'm going to refine that a little bit and say that it's seeing your subtlest mind and the guru deities. You know, sometimes you hear guru deity or the guru and the deity. Because the guru is a Buddha, so he's already operating off, he or she's already operating with their subtlest mind. And the deity's subtlest mind, of course, is a Buddha. The deity's a Buddha. So you're seeing the unity of the subtlest mind of me, the deity, and the guru. They're inseparably one. And that inseparability is like really, really, really important. Now, Why is deity, so you know, you answered it partly, Robbie, but the real thing that I'm trying to get at is, if you try to do deity yoga, if you just pick up a book and you don't really understand it, and you say, okay, I'm, you know, superhuman, or I'm wonderful, I'm a Buddha now, you know, well, what's missing? Several lots missing, but the sadhana's missing and reality's missing. Yeah, but
motivation.
Pardon?
Motivation.
Motivation, which should be what?
The bodhicitta motivation.
Behind, what else? What else? Really, really important piece is missing. Like the most important piece.
God. Besides the initiation.
Well, the initiation's missing too, but that's an important piece. But it's called emptiness yoga. You got to be able to see. You got to be able to meditate. You got to be able to. We need see our biggest obstacle right now to spiritual development is what? Our limited self-view. We have a spiritual inferiority complex. We have an inferiority complex in general. We don't think that we have, that we're capable of being happy no matter what, getting enlightened, achieving liberation, enlightenment. You know, we don't have, we don't think that we have these amazing potentials within us. So it's so important. This is why the teachings on Buddha nature are so important. Because they really tap in, and this is something that, you know, as Dalai Lama said, I can talk about this all day long, but until you really get down and do some practice for yourself and get a sense and get to know your mind, it's only then that you'll begin to really taste and get a sense of your potential. It's like the words coming from Don Brown or even His Holiness the Dalai Lama are not going to get you moving until you see, you know, I remember Lama Yeshe back in the end of the day. You know, he would send a lot of the new students off to do retreats, and he'd say, you know, this is really about you getting to know your mind, this retreat, even though it was tantric and very kind of had a lot of pieces to it that were difficult. It was really about learning your own mind. So anyway, so we got this, we have this inferiority complex, and so when an ordinary person all of a sudden thinks that they're a Buddha, you know, that's like putting, you know, I use the example, it's sort of like putting on a wetsuit, you know, on top of, it's not, you know, it's different, it's distinct. What should happen is that we dissolve into, you know, we look at all of our concepts about ourselves, the whole identity that we have about me and I, and we meditate on emptiness. We do this emptiness yoga, and till we, you know, dissolve everything, our physical body, and really what appears to the mind is called space-like meditation, a meditative equipoise on emptiness. I can't say that twice real fast. Space-like meditative equipoise on emptiness. But what happens is, what appears to the mind is spaciousness, because you imagine the whole universe dissolves in your body, and your body dissolves into your heart, and then your heart dissolves into a seed syllable, and then that thing just gets smaller and smaller until everything physical in the universe disappears. So there's nothing but spaciousness, and what's apprehended. So what appears as space and what the mind apprehends is the emptiness of any kind of substantial, concrete, real, inherent, true existence. Okay, so that's, you know, the spaciousness can join with the correct view of reality, okay? And motivated by this, to help others, we kind of, from this space of emptiness, we emerge as the deity. Not as, in my case, it's not Don Brown becoming Green Tara, for example. It would be, you know, from the space of emptiness, appears a Buddha. Okay? A Buddha form, like, let's say, Green Tara. And as much as possible, I try to get as much clarity as I can of myself as a body made of light. Every atom of my being exists for one purpose, and that's to help others. It's the perfect body of a 16-year-old girl. Everything is just unbelievably perfect and divine in every way. And I have this amazing ability to take compassionate action in any situation. No?
Then I think, okay, I am Tara. And I label Tara me. Not I'm Don Brown pretending to be Tara. No, I am Tara. And I have these amazing
quality. You know, the potential for... You know, the potential for, to do whatever's necessary to stop others suffering and so on. So that's called divine identity. And it's really, really important. It is so important. Divine identity. Where you identify with basically your Buddha nature. And now, you know, some of you may go, well, this is just fantasy. This is just fantasy. But I'm going to say this. You seeing yourself as a deity, given, and this is, my argument is that we all have Buddha nature, okay? Us seeing ourselves as a deity has more reality than how we see ourselves right now. It's more valid than how we see ourselves now. Because how we see ourselves now is totally based on ignorance. It's totally based on a view of inherent existence. It's based on all the stories we've made up about ourselves that we believed in, that we've turned them into novels and, you know, and libraries, you know. And we haul that stuff around, you know. No wonder by the time we're 50, it's hard to smile after a while. You know, you got a library you're hauling around on your back. Anyway, so that's really an important part of Deity Yoga. Now, can we turn the AC just a little bit? I want a little cooler. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I went a little cool. I'm sweating. I don't know if it has anything to do with the fact I'm drinking hot tea or not. I kind of doubt it. Any questions so far? Yeah, Rami.
Could you just say something about the word deity?
Could you say something about the word deity? What it means? How is it used here? Because when we hear that word, we think God.
Deity.
Do you have a better translation?
DEI or? Here's what Geshe Taishi Tsering says about the word deity. Enlightened beings manifest in different aspects to best benefit sentient beings. The historical Buddha Shakyamuni manifested as an ordinary monk in order to establish the Dharma and the community of Sangha. It is a different manifestation of enlightened beings, however, that we call deities. There are many deities in Tibetan Buddhism. Tara, Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, Vajrasattva has to do with purification. Let's see. And so forth. These deities are enlightened beings, but it's mis- mistaken to feel that they, like Shakyamuni Buddha, were once people who sat under the Bodhi tree and attained enlightenment. Rather, they are manifestations of a... This is really important. They are manifestations of a particular enlightened energy. Individual beings attain enlightenment through practicing an attitude such as compassion. Their enlightened minds then manifest into Chinrezig or Tara aspect. For instance, the compassionate action aspect of an enlightened being manifests as Tara, Avalokitesvara, as the Buddha's compassion. Anyway, so deity, you know, obviously gods, it has to do with, you know, gods, but it's Alex Berzin is offended by the word deity, and he calls them Buddha forms. Sorry, he's a translator, and he always wants to, he says, I don't like that translation. A lot of times he's very accurate because the connotation of deity is God, but it's not really that. It's a Buddha form, a meditational deity that we use. And it's kind of interesting because once you become a deity, you know, once you've manifested as a deity, then all of a sudden, you know, how are you supposed to see yourself in the meditation practice and also outside the meditation practice? Okay? Now, here's the thing that has to be present. Let me just say these three things have to be present when you arise as the deity. Okay? There has to be what I call divine pride or divine identity. Okay? That's number one. Number two, there has to be clarity. And the greater the clarity of your visualization of yourself as the deity, let's say if you're Kala Chakra or Tara, the greater your or the easier it is for you to develop this divine identity. And then the third aspect of it is called the profundity. The profundity aspect. And that has to do with your awareness that all of this is empty. That you are manifesting as a deity who is completely empty of inherent existence at every moment of his or her being. It's all empty. So that's the profound aspect of it. So you develop divine pride of yourself. You have a clear appearance of yourself as the deity, you know, and you also have this awareness that you are completely empty. You've imagined yourself into existence, which is exactly what we do now, but we don't know it, isn't it? If you think about it, we imagine ourselves into existence, but we believe everything we think, and you know everything is real and solid and concrete and heavy. You know, but it's our mind that creates our identity. Why can't we create the identity as a divine being? Why should we create the identity as a old, getting older, you know, creaky, you know, limited? Yeah, well, I am, as a matter of fact. I'm just describing it to you. You know, this whole limited self image we have is the biggest obstacle to spiritual practice, and the reason that the sutra path takes three countless eons, and Tantra, you can do it in 3 years. Because, you know, you're slugging it out with your conceptual mind. Here's what Geshe Toshi Tsering says. I thought this was very cool. I even put a red star next to it, if I can find it. And he's like, I really think he's an amazing teacher. Okay. Now, I'm not talking much about guru yoga here and things like that a lot of people do talk about. I think it's important. But, you know, there's only so much we can do in this class. Well, here's what he says. This is kind of cool. He says, it is not as if we slip a deity body on top of an imperfect body like some rubber suit. We actually feel that we are the deity and our body is the divine body of a deity. Now listen to that. We actually feel that we are the deity and that our body is the divine body of the deity. With this level of identification with the deity, we have the power to completely purify our sense of ordinariness. You know, our sense of ordinariness is our biggest obstacle to spiritual happiness. And he says with seeing ourselves as the deity is the way to completely purify that. And then he goes on to say in the next sentence, where the Sutrayana chips away at our delusions, here we blast them into non-existence with the power of our pure visualizations. And it's true. Sutrayana is just chipping away, chipping away, chipping away. You know, you see the enemy and you do your analytical meditation. Well, they used to be my friend in a past lifetime and it's changeable. And, you know, what goes around comes around. It's just my karma. And, you know, you try to change them. You change them into seeing into either a neutral being or, you know, maybe somebody that you have compassion for. Well, this practice, that's the sutra method. It's great. And that's what we teach here at Gaudama Center 99.9% of the time. But somebody that can practice at this level and has this ability to visualize can blast their delusions into non-existence with the power of our pure visualizations. It's in this book on page 12. All right, so he's talking about the four complete purities. So I'm going to say this. This is not in Lama Zopa's or Lama Yeshe's book either, but I'm going to talk about it because it's kind of cool. It says once you've arisen as the deity, then you've got the complete. Then you're supposed to see your. So right now, imagine. Just I'm going to snap my fingers. I want you to imagine that your ordinary sense of self has gone, and now you are, let's say you're Medicine Buddha. Everybody in here, bam, is Medicine Buddha now. And you go, wow, I'm Medicine Buddha. I have this amazing capacity to heal and so on. Anyway, so we develop some divine pride. And then there are four ways that we need to see the world. The first one's called the complete purity of the environment. So what you do, what we do is we imagine that, and we are part of this perfect universe. It's called you ever heard of a mandala? There's a usually in every tantric practice, there's a circular representation of the universe. It's usually like a blueprint, and it can come up in three dimensions. But there's a celestial mansion in the middle of it. We're the deity in the center of Medicine Buddha's celestial mansion, and around that is the universe around him in the form of a mandala. Well, this is our pure environment. But when we take this initiation, we're empowered to visualize ourselves as a deity in this mandala. And one of the things that this is supposed to do, again, is to combat this sense of ordinariness, that everything around us is divine. Divine. It sounds like my mom. Oh, how was dinner? Divine. But, you know, divine is divinity, deity, all these words, you know, keep cropping back up. Another one is the complete purity of the body. You know, and that has to get, that gets back to see, to not seeing ourselves as ordinary in any aspect, including our body. But our body, again, made out of light, has unlimited potential to reach out and help beings. Then another one is the complete purity of resources. So, like all the offerings, things that we offer, things that we're given, things that we utilize in our lives, everything takes on a divine aspect to it. everything that we come into contact with, that we come into contact with in, with our senses, takes on the aspect of kind of a divinity. And the last one is the complete purity of activities. So whatever we do, whether it's the speech, could be when we hear somebody talking, we think, well, that's mantra. Instead of just ordinary speech, it has a quality of mantra. All of our actions are those of a divine being. So any eating, it takes on special meaning. Actions of generosity, because we are divine, because we are deity, actions of generosity, and we see ourselves as a deity, empty of inherent existence. So every activity that we do is thousands, maybe millions of times more powerful, because it's done with this special quality of mind that only Tantra can generate. So what's actually happening in Tantra that we talk about, there are a lot of unique features in Tantra, but we're utilizing in Tantra, particularly at the highest level, subtler and subtler levels of mind. But they talk about how in Sutra you can do, you can practice method and wisdom, but not at the same time. Okay? Like in Sutra, the method part of it would be like the six perfections. The first five perfections would be method, wouldn't it? Generosity, ethics, patience and tolerance, enthusiasm and concentration. All those would fall under the genre of what we call the method aspect. Compassion is also a principal method in Mahayana Buddhism. Wisdom is the wisdom aspect. So there's always method and wisdom, those two wings of the bird, right? Well, in Tantra, those two things merge into one moment of mind, because the method is deity yoga. The method is we're manifesting as an enlightened being who's capable of all the actions of an enlightened being. And so that is, it sounds weird, but that's equivalent to method. Seeing ourselves as a pure being, as a deity. And then our awareness of the deity is empty is the wisdom aspect of it. It's the wisdom aspect of it. Now, let me say this too, because I'm jumping around, but it's kind of because also in Highest Yoga Tantra, they talk about the method is bliss and emptiness. So bliss and emptiness are method and wisdom conjoined. Again, this is why in Highest Yoga Tantra, a lot of the iconography is of male and female in union, because it's the union of bliss and emptiness. The union of method and wisdom, but the principal method is bliss. Now, why is bliss so good? Why is bliss so important?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Thanks. So, what you've talked about is very inviting and interesting to think about, but that's not something we should do, correct?
What's that?
And imagine, that we have all the four purities and think about that,
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We should do that.
We should do that, but not as a specific.
If you've been deity. If you have had a tantric initiation.
What if you haven't?
If you haven't, then no. You're not supposed to see yourself as a deity until you've been introduced to the practice by a qualified tantric master.
So you should not think of any of the purities as yourself as manifesting any of those.
That's actually, again, this gets back to the whole business of finding a qualified teacher,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
getting
that makes sense.
Getting a proper, making sure that you have good understanding of the three principles of the path, and that you've gotten yourself qualified, and then you meet the teacher, and you're convinced that you can see this mm-hmm. being as a Buddha, And then you get a proper empowerment or initiation into that practice, and then you go from there. Then you have the permission. See, the empowerment is a guided meditation with you and the guru. Okay, the guru is guiding you through basically the sadhana, but it's not exactly the sadhana because there's different aspects to initiations. But the guru is guiding you through the experience of what that sadhana might be like, and being that Buddha and seeing whatever they see in their mandala and so on and so on. So yeah, you're not empowered to do that until you. I mean, you're not at least. And some people do it anyway.
Well,
some people go practice tantra without an initiation. But I've seen some bad outcomes.
I just wanted to be clear on, excuse me, what was actually practicing tantra, and what you were describing did sound like that. I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't something we should do. Just,
well, you know, I'm supposed to teach this class on introduction.
Well, I mean, this is like a tour of tantra.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
I'm trying
so
to give you a taste of what what's in the books. I'm not making any of this up. His Holiness and Lama Yeshe and Geshe Tashi Sering have all said these things. They're in the books that you can read. Well, let me read this little segment here on bliss, because it's everybody likes bliss, right? Who doesn't want bliss? His Holiness says, because everybody wants to know, at least I do, how do you generate bliss? How do you generate the experience of great bliss, excuse me, in Tantra, which is what, here is when the drops melt within your body, you experience a unique sensation. So the drops, he's talking about, you know, the central channel, right? And the nadis, remember we visualized that when we did the inner heat meditation. So, and then there are chakras here and here and here, right? A heart, and then I think one here and one here. And that at least five, and there may be more. But anyway, he's talking about drops melting in your body. You experience a unique sensation originating in the central channel. This gives rise to a powerful experience of physical bliss, which in turn brings your mind to a very subtle level of experience, which is permeated by mental bliss. When you then reflect on your understanding of emptiness, this mental bliss is automatically conjoined with emptiness. This is the method of conjoining bliss and emptiness. So, here's why bliss is so important. It's not bliss for bliss' sake. It's bliss because what you want to do is realize emptiness. Well, when your mind is blissful, does it want to go anywhere? Are you bored? No way. Your mind is so satisfied, so happy, so peaceful. And then it's focused on reality, which is even more with a, and bliss also accesses a very subtle, powerful level of mind. So when you're accessing the most subtle level of mind, which is the clear light consciousness, which is a blissful state of mind, if you can harness it and focus that on ultimate reality, wow, you can make progress very, very quickly. So this Holiness is talking about this. Then he says, it's important to understand the exact meaning of each term or expression in Tantra, especially given the multiplicity of meanings that vary according to the different contexts. Generally, there are three distinct types of bliss. The bliss caused by emission of regenerative fluids, the bliss derived from the flow of the vital elements within the energy channels, and finally, the bliss known in Tantra as immutable bliss. In Tantric practice, the latter two types of bliss are those utilized for realizing emptiness. So he's talking about the bliss derived from the flow of the vital, the energies in the channels and chakras and stuff like that, the central channel, and then what he calls immutable bliss. In tantric practice, these two latter types of bliss are utilizing realizing emptiness. The bliss derived from the movement of the elements in the channels and immutable bliss. Because of the significance of utilizing bliss and realizing emptiness, many meditational deities and highest Yoga Tantra are depicted in sexual embrace. As we discussed before, this bliss is very different from that experienced during ordinary sexual intercourse. So just trying to debunk some of the, you know, this is, you know, they're not talking about, you know, the pedestrian version of whatever. You know, that sort of, you know, that kind of bliss. It's much different than that. Yes.
Press it until it's green.
Say what?
You just have to press it.
And now, this is kind of a question. I guess I'm not too terribly familiar with this, but it's my understanding, in like the Indian, maybe more the Hindu traditions, they have this concept of like the Kundalini energy associated with
same thing.
Originate, you know, it still has ties to like sort of the sexual energy in the pedestrian sense, and that you know, it can just be released, you know, sort of in a pedestrian way, or it can be cultivated and sort of rised inside the body. And is this sort of the same basis, or is this just like 100%? Is there sort of like a co-reference there, like referencing the same thing, or is there some sort of fundamental like backing that these both support and they're kind of approaching it differently, or is it just 100% like just different concepts?
It's different, but there's a lot of similarities, but it's different. The big difference, let me say this. What are the big difference between Hindu tantra and Buddhist tantra? That was one of the homework questions.
Just with work, I missed a couple of the classes.
Okay.
I'm trying to catch up.
Well, here's the big difference. I think the two biggest differences are that in Buddhist tantra, and one of the gentlemen who was here last week, he knew something about Hindu tantra, and he said it's about increasing your personal power. And in Buddhist tantra, the motivation for practicing it for the ideal practitioner is that you want to become enlightened as quickly as possible. That you cannot, you know, you just find that, you know, you have a sense of urgency, and you want to find the quickest method to, you know, to develop your, you know, to become a Buddha, basically. And this is it. This is the fastest method to do it, if you're qualified. If you're not qualified, you'll end up on the rocks. You know? And I've seen a couple people go crazy, and one person burned herself up. Right?
So it can cause like mental disorders.
No, the people probably weren't that bright. I mean, they probably didn't have any business doing it anyway. Yeah, and they were not. I mean, if you visualize yourself as like a Vajrayogini, and you know, with flames coming out of every pore in your body, and you can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality, then what's going to keep you from pouring kerosene on yourself and lighting a match, which is what you did? Gotcha, yeah. You got to be stable. And you got to have a teacher. You got to have somebody you can relate to who can, if you were to get into some place like that, you could get bailed out. You know, you got help. You know, I saw some other people who weren't all that stable. Plus, living in India for 6 months at a time is enough to drive some people crazy anyway. But anyway, you know, around the Tantra is really working with energies now. It's why it's more powerful, I think, than Sutra, because it's dealing with, you know, the subtle energy winds in the body, the Kundalini energy and all of that. But I was going to say this too, that you know, the texts are very clear about this. You cannot get enlightened in this lifetime without taking a consort. They call it an action seal. It's like a real consort. Now,
a
A person. Yes. A real person of the opposite sex. You know, and to be, but this is, there's a lot of, I'm not going to say too much about this because Sarah Brooks will be listening to this and scolding me tomorrow for sure.
We'll turn the mic off.
No, but Lama Tsongkhapa, for example, he didn't take a consort. And a lot of the great Galupa Lamas, they don't take consorts. They go, you know, they develop the illusory body, or they develop themselves, and then they get enlightened at the time of death. That's how it's talked about in the text. That these lamas that don't take, you know, action seals or real consorts, because you can't be a monk and have a you got vows of celibacy, so that's in Lama Tsongkhapa. There was so much confusion, and I guess they had really perverted Buddhism, tantric Buddhism, so badly in Tibet at some point, you know, where it was just kind of a sexual cult, much as it is in this country, I guess, and people that read the lay literature, no pun intended. But you know that Lama Tsongkhapa felt like it was important to keep it. To keep the consort practice out of it, and to stress the monastic aspect, because to practice at that level, you have to be extraordinarily gifted. In other words, you have to have done the generation stage, which is not all that hard to do, but it is important to get that foundation. And then after you've done that, and it's said that when you can visualize the mandala and all the deities in it for 4 hours without losing, I may be getting this wrong, but without losing focus for even 1 second, then you're ready for completion stage practices. So it's completion stage, which is the stage where you might take a consort. You have to be extraordinarily talented. You have to be very, very, very great practitioner, really to the point where you wouldn't even care. You're doing this because this is what you need to do. You need to arouse that energy of desire. Now, again, we haven't talked about that too much either, but I'll say this about desire. I would feel like reading some stuff about it more than, let's see what Geshe Toshi Sering kind of hits it on the nail. That way I don't have to make anything up. But here he goes. All right, so he's talking about, you know, we talk about desire or attachment. Attachment, you know, because desire is not necessarily a problem. It's just when it gets this healthy desire and afflictive desire, right? Afflictive desire is the kind that's sticky, that, you know, clings. It's that clinging desire that gets us into trouble. The desire to be happy, the desire to be healthy and stuff like that. Those are not necessarily problems. Only when they become addictions do they become problems. So desire generally is, and all the afflictive emotions, anger and everything, but desire is picked on most, are considered to be obstacles, right? So when we look at the eight worldly dharmas, I've mentioned several times, we're addicted to deliciousness. We do, you know, pleasure, gain, fame, and praise. We're all addicted to that. We're all addicted or cling to not having pain, loss, disgrace, and blame. It's just natural to be that way. So we single out desire as a big problem in spiritual practice because it causes all of our suffering. And here they're saying, bring it on. Lama Yeshe says, perfect. Tantra is perfect for Westerners because we're so lewd and lascivious that it's a perfect practice for us. But it's like, bring on desire. In Tantra, bring it on. Because we can use the energy of desire to transform our mind. But what can you stand? What can you take? How much desire can you handle without going berserk? Right? For example, even anger. If you get angry, let's say something happens that makes you angry, but then you recollect emptiness, right? And so all of a sudden, the sense of I that was offended and insulted disappears, and the inherently existent other, you know, disappears into the spacious of emptiness, and what you're left with is the energy of anger, but no anger. Just the energy of anger. And you can use that in your meditation. You can use that in your visualization to develop, you know, qualities such as correct view of reality. Same way with desire. The energy of desire turns back on itself when you cultivate desire. And they talk about it in the four levels of Tantra. There's action, performance, yoga, and Hatha yoga. In action Tantra, it's using the desire of just gazing on some pleasant object, like beautiful green Tara, 16-year-old, you know, beautiful lady made of light. Kind of picks up your energy, doesn't it? When you see an attractive person, doesn't it make you kind of buoys your mind a little bit, right? So use that. Then the next one would be, the next level of desire would be, so performance Tantra would be like smiling and, you know, kind of joking around with the person. And that desire becomes a little bit more powerful. Can you maintain your, can you maintain your control of your mind, you know, and your dignity, so to speak, with that level of desire? Okay, if you can, great. Now you're ready for Yoga Tantra, which is the desire that comes from holding hands. And if you can handle that, then there's a desire of sexual embrace. Can you, you know, manage to keep from going, losing your mind, so to speak, or going berserk, losing your ability to concentrate and recollect emptiness and recollect compassion in that moment of sexual embrace? Well, most of us can't. Geshe-Toshi Tsering said, to understand these ascending levels of practice, think of the attraction to a sexual partner. It's said that at the first level of Vajrayana, Kriya Tantra, the practitioner can use the energy equivalent to seeing an attractive sexual partner. In Charya, or performance Tantra, he or she can use the energy equivalent to flirting with the person. In Yoga Tantra, with touching each other. And with High Yoga Tantra, the practitioner must be able to use the energy of the actual sexual encounter on the path. That means that he or she can take the energy and use it without being overwhelmed by attachment to the partner or the act. And then he goes on to say, I suspect not many of us are ready for that just yet. It sounds great. I mean, everybody, of course, if just having ordinary sex were the cause of enlightenment, hey, we'd all be there. You know, there'd be a lot of enlightened people, but obviously we have to bring more to it than just the bliss of that and, you know, the pleasure of that experience. It has to be much more profound than that, and the preparation has to be complete.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes. Go ahead.
The baton.
Thank you. I guess you have to be sure also not to use anyone in this. Thinking of the partner. I mean, is that mentioned?
It is. It said the ideal partner is somebody that's on the same level, spiritual level, as you are.
Okay.
But I mean, obviously, it's a very high level.
Yeah.
If you practice at that level, it's a very high level.
This all happens in 3 years.
Well, it could.
I'm just joking. Yeah, I'm just thinking about
it. I mean, a lot of people, I'll be honest with you, a lot of Westerners particularly, and a lot of Tibetans too, they, you know, they call it the Great Retreat. It's 3 years, 3 months, and 3 day retreat. I know people that have done it 2-3 times. They are not enlightened yet. And they're not practicing with consort either, by the way. They're doing visualization. And here's the thing. As I said, my friends Roger and Paula, they both said that doing deity yoga and these tantric practices really, really strengthened their understanding and experience of the Lam Rim. You know, of things like impermanence and the importance of refuge and the suffering of all sentient beings and their own personal suffering and you know, different aspects of the path, all of that got reinforced as part of tantric practice. And that's actually the real goal of tantra, is to quickly have a realization of bodhicitta and emptiness. More quickly than we would get through the sutra path. So, you know, again, the, you know, using, an, you know, everybody, I mean, it's kind of, you know, you might say kind of, you know, it seems like, wow, that's pretty cool that, that there's a spiritual practice out there that can use, you know, sex, which everybody's interested in, as part of the path. Well, it's only can be part of the path to a certain level of practitioner. For most of us, it just creates, like drinking salt water, it just creates, you know, kind of an addiction for more and more, and it doesn't wake us up at all. It creates more confusion. And so there's, you know, that's really, that's why I try to, at multiple times during this class, try to point out that this is not the pedestrian tantra that the Tibetan Buddhism's talking about, even though it doesn't, as you can imagine, doesn't shun anything. Tantra doesn't shun anything. It doesn't push anything away. The things that got pushed away in sutra, like attachment, tantra says, bring it on, we'll work with it. Anger, bring it on, we'll work with it. Fear, bring it on, we'll work with it. Whatever the delusion is, meat, alcohol, this is why there's risk involved, particularly in the completion stage, highest yoga tantra, that people can make, there's a risk for abuses and stuff like that. And as Venerable Rabina has pointed out, you know, you maybe I better not repeat what she said. Well, I think the point is that, you know, when you practice at this level with a guru, you better be darn sure you've got the right guru, that you pick somebody that, and ultimately, you're responsible for your own business. You know, even though you promised to see the, His Holiness pointed out in this book, he said, look, he said, if it's said in the text that if your guru asks you to do something that you consider to be non-virtuous, and you've given yourself and you've decided to see this person as a perfect Buddha, but now they've asked you to do something that you clearly know is wrong, or for you, it's wrong. It doesn't resonate with what you understand. Then you have every right to extricate yourself from that situation and say, excuse me, I'm not comfortable, or this doesn't work for me. And then you leave. Either you don't do it and you stay, or you don't do it and you leave that guru and go find a new one. You have that option to do that. And that's completely acceptable. And it's important that His Holiness is perfectly aware of the abuses of both male and female, quote, gurus who have taken advantage. Well, I don't want to say that because everybody's responsible for themselves. But there have been some situations that haven't ended well, you know, and a lot of misunderstanding and lawsuits and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so this is, since we've still got one more class, unfortunately. I mean, fortunately, we're going to do some meditations. We're going to do Vajrasattva, and we're going to do several of these sadhanas next time, so you can get a lot of taste of it. But this is Geshe Sampa's bell. This is such a nice one. Oh, my God. Look at the detail on this thing, and listen to the sound of it. What'd you say? Yes. It's just beautiful. I'm not good at ringing the bells. Listen to that one. So the bell is always held in the left hand, and the bell symbolizes wisdom, and that's equated with female energy. I don't know why. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, it is. You know, it's equated with female energy, and the vajra is always held in the right hand, and it's equated with male energy. Vajra, it's like adamantine, diamond, hard, you know, and it's equated with, so wisdom, method, female and male. And then you cross, and then you see this crossing like this, and this is the union of method and wisdom, right? So female energy, it's not the union of male and female energy necessarily, it's the union of bliss and emptiness, of wisdom and method, the chief principal method being the, you know, bliss. So, yeah, like that. And then, in the tantric sadhanas, you know, these methods of accomplishment, and I think Shigelik plays a Damaru, doesn't he? I can't do this very well. But anyway, it's a hand drum. And he'll ring the bell like that, and he and Geshe Sampa are really good at this. But anyway, you know, the little Damaru is called Damaru. It's part of the sound offering. There are lots of offerings in a tantric sadhana. There are lots of sound offerings. This also has something to do, I've heard, with calling the dakinis. I'm not sure if that's true. But anyway, I think you can get a sense how vast tantra is from the last 4 weeks of this. Any questions? Everybody looks kind of shell-shocked, except a few people.
Sit over here.
Oh, well, I think bodhicitta and emptiness are the biggies. And, I think, wait a minute, there was maybe one more. I think, I'm not sure there's a huge emphasis on guru yoga in Tibetan Tantra. I'm not sure that that's part of Hindu Tantra, although the guru-disciple relationship is important in Hindu Tantra. But I think the biggest difference is emptiness yoga and the motivation being bodhicitta. Those are the big ones. Yeah.
On the topic of the cultivation of desire, with the consort and the bliss energy.
Right.
I know that with the Hindu practices, there's an emphasis on cultivation of those energies through using the breath, and specifically breath retention. And I know that Geshe-la's talked a lot about the nine round and a couple of the other breathing techniques he has. Oh, sorry, is this something that's covered in another class?
No. Have you done the Vaz breathing, the inner heat meditation that I handed out?
No.
That's a breath holding meditation, where you bring the energy down. Rob, you got that, don't you? You can give it to him. That's exactly that. And look, this in High Sugar Tantra, completion stage practices. There's yogas that they work with Kundalini energy, moving the energy in drops through the different channels. You know, that's one of the ways to evoke the subtlest level of consciousness, right? So it's very similar. The biggest difference is compassion, the compassionate motivation of bodhicitta, and emptiness yoga. And that's a huge difference. And I think also, it's not about personal power. It's about the reason you're doing it. The only reason you're practicing Tantra is so you can help others quickly. That's not part of Hindu yoga, Hindu Tantra.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me just, I have to throw some terms out here just so you guys can feel like you've gotten your money's worth. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention money. I should have done it the first class. But anyway, please give generously to support Kadampa Center, because we don't charge for anything. Okay. So the homework. A couple of things I haven't talked about that I think I need to just mention this. Everything else is I've covered pretty much. Um, I'll go over this in detail next time. But this has to do with the three bodies of a Buddha. The Buddha has like different forms that when you get enlightened, you can take different forms. The first body of the Buddha is called a truth body. Okay? And the Sanskrit word, if I had any juice left in my synovial joints, I could get up and write this, but I don't. It's called the Dharmakaya. Robbie, would you write that, please? Oh, the Dharmakaya, or the truth body. Now, you're going to hear this over and over again, so it's good to write it down if you're going to read about the bodies of the Buddha. The truth body, that's the mind of the Buddha. Okay, and in generation stage practices, you know, there's a place where you dissolve, where you imagine that you're dying, right? You do a death dissolution. Those of you who've been doing discovering Buddhism, you do a death dissolution meditation. You imagine that you're dying, and then you imagine that this subtlest consciousness, the pure, you know, the so-called clear light of emptiness, that subtlest consciousness arises. That's the truth body of the Buddha. You know, that's the subtlest, most powerful level of consciousness that we have. And we actually experience it now while we're alive. When you sneeze, when you have an orgasm, and I can't think of the third, when you faint. Yeah. Those are three times when you can get a glimpse of that subtlest clear light consciousness. But anyway, that's called the Dharmakaya, or the truth body of the Buddha. The Buddha can also manifest as something called it's called the enjoyment body, and the Sanskrit term is the Sambhogakaya. Sambhogakaya. Robbie, how good is your spelling? Sambhogakaya. S-A-M-B-H-O G-A Kaya. Sambhogakaya. So that's the enjoyment body. And you know, in the generation stage, you know, when you know the Buddha's mind is there, and then just, you know, rather than going into the ordinary bardo, and this is the in-between state, you know, a Buddha, as they're evolving, this is a subtle level of mind, but it's not the subtlest level of mind. The Dharmakaya is the subtlest. It's the same subtle level of mind, but it's manifesting as a Sambhogakaya. Now, when the Buddha taught all of these tantras, all of these tantras, he taught them in the Sambhogakaya aspect. He didn't teach them as the monk, Shakyamuni Buddha. So, for example, when he manifested as the medicine Buddha or as Tara, those are all Sambhogakaya manifestations of the Buddha. Now, ordinary beings like us cannot see the Sambhogakaya manifestation of the Buddha. You have to be an Arya being. You have to be someone who's had really high spiritual attainments and has actually seen emptiness directly to be able to see the Buddha. But, okay, and then the next level is up, is the Nirmanakaya. It's called the emanation body of the Buddha. And so that's what Shakyamuni Buddha was. He was a 2,500 years ago, and let's just say, you know, the Dalai Lama's a Buddha, who we don't know for sure, do we? We don't know anybody's mind, but let's just say there are some Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya manifestations or emanations of the enlightenment that we can relate to. So of these three bodies of the Buddha, the only one we can relate to is the Nirmanakaya. We can't. Now, the two bodies of the Buddha that can help living beings, sentient beings, are what? The Sambhogakaya, because they can help the Arya beings, and the Nirmanakaya, which can help us. But nobody, you know, the mind of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya mind of the Buddha can't help anybody, because, you know, it's just not able to. So, and so these two, the last two, the Sambhogakaya or the enjoyment body and the Nirmanakaya or the emanation body, are together, sometimes grouped together and called the Rupakaya or they're called the form bodies of the Buddha. They're the form bodies of the Buddha. So in essence, there's the truth body and the form body. Okay? Those are the two bodies of the Buddha. And we have to create the causes for the truth body and the form body. The causes for the truth body, or the Dharmakaya, is what? The wisdom of emptiness. The cause for the Rupakaya, or the form body of the Buddha, are the aspects of method. You know, bodhicitta, all the different aspects of method, including, deity yoga and moving the drops in the channels and bliss. So all of that is considered to be, part of the method aspect.
Method is form body, truth body is what? Wisdom?
Say it again now.
I didn't get it. Truth body is wisdom.
Truth body is wisdom, and the form body is are the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya. And these are technical terms, but they come up again and again. And in the highest yoga tantra, in the generation practice, taking the three bodies of the Buddha is essential to every time you do the practice. You have to rise as the truth body, and you have divine pride in yourself as I am the Dharmakaya. And then from that, you imagine that I am the Sambhogakaya. I'm the enjoyment body. You know, and you go, but I can't help anybody like this. So how can I help others? Oh, I need to be a Nirmanakaya. So you have divine pride in being the Sambhogakaya, but you can only help a few people like that. But you want to help lots of people. So you then go, okay, now I'm going to manifest as a Buddha now. And you could manifest as whatever highest yoga tantra deity you would manifest, whatever practice you're doing, you manifest as that. And then you label that deity I. Not ordinary, but based on emptiness yoga and based on what we talked about, clear appearance and this profound understanding of emptiness, the clarity of seeing ourselves as the deity, with divine pride and with profound understanding of emptiness, that's what manifests. You know, that's what can help beings. So that's the Nirmanakaya aspect, that we imagine we are that now. So that's pretty powerful stuff. Well, there's lots I could say, but we're out of time. So this is every time I do this class, by the way, nobody else at Kadapa Center will teach this course.
You like it.
No, because they say, that nobody, you shouldn't teach this to anybody, people who are not prepared. And of course, none of us are really prepared. And so, they say, I'm going to the hell realms, it's a long story. But it's, pardon?
Thank you for risking.
No, I'm pretty sure I'm on my way. But, it is such a juicy part of Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, if you look at the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa, and, you get a sense that they don't live in the same world we do. You know what I mean? If you met Lama Zopa when he was here, right? I don't know how many did. But, you meet these people and you go, wow, they're so happy. And, they've got, and I've been watching Lama Zopa for 35 years and His Holiness for almost that long. And I think these people are extraordinary. And so, when you see these people that are sort of, the proof is in the pudding. Like, if this practice is so profound, there ought to be a lot of amazing human beings out there that the result of it, because it is the main practice in Tibetan Buddhism is highest yoga tantra. It is. But we don't emphasize it here because I think Geshe-la's, out of his compassion, keeps, he wants us to get a really, 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 really strong foundation in the basic practices before we get exposed to these practices, which not only require a qualified tantric master to guide us, but also, require commitment. Yeah. A daily commitment to a daily practice for the rest of your life. You know, you just can't just blow it off. So everybody got their homework. Good. Please take it home. And it's an open book. If you can answer these questions, great. I've got the answer sheet right here. We'll go over it next week, or maybe I'll even print it out and give it to you. But, yeah, we've got answer sheets, too. And we'll do the dedications.